Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this evening's talk of the Staple Inn Actuarial Society. My name is Emma Hutchinson, and I'm the programme convener for SIAS. Before I introduce tonight's talk, I just have a couple of notices about upcoming SIAS events. Dates for SIAS talks in 2019 have now been published on our website, and our next talk is scheduled for Tuesday, the 15th of January. Further details and online registration for this will be available on the website shortly. The SIAS pub quiz will take place on Thursday, the 31st of January. Further details and tickets for this event are available on our website. Next, just a few standard notices about tonight's event. Tonight's event is hosted by SIAS. We do encourage those of you that aren't currently SIAS members to join. Membership is extremely good value, £23 for IFOA fellows and £12 for IFOA students. And further details with regard to joining are available on the website. There is an attendance sheet in the smaller room just outside the hall. If you didn't sign this on the way in, please don't forget to sign it on the way out. Attendance at the talks doesn't automatically get added to your CPD record. So please update your CPD in the normal way after tonight. We're eager for our talks to run as smoothly and effectively as possible, and we'd be delighted to hear any feedback you have. We will email you a short online survey after the talk. Please do take a minute or two to complete this. We need your feedback to create the best possible experience for our members. If the fire alarm sounds during the meeting, please exit using the fire exits at the back of the hall. And finally, just a reminder to switch your mobile phones on silent. Tonight's talk will last around 1 hour, and it'll be followed by a Q&A with the speaker. If you have a question, please raise your hand and a microphone will be brought to you. There is a bottle of champagne on offer for the best contribution to the discussion by a student member of the IFOA, and another for the best contribution from any fellow of the IFOA. Please clearly state your name and which of these categories you fall into before you ask your questions. Following the meeting, there will be sandwiches and networking drinks in the smaller room just outside the hall. Please do join us for this. So back to tonight's talk. Our speaker, Ian McKeever, has had a diverse actuarial career, initially working in conventional life assurance with the Pearl, and then moving on to investment with the Independent Order of Foresters. Following that, Ian moved into pensions consultancy with Noble Loans before starting his own consultancy, advising small schemes and providing expert witness services. During that time, he also became a member of the Society of Trust and Estate Practitioners. However, Ian has told me that the lesson that taught him the most of what he knows about investment started off when he was a student in the back of a post office van delivering Christmas cards. And without further ado, I'll now hand you over to Ian, who can tell you about this story and talk to his recent paper on pensions freedoms.
I wasn't aware that I was going to tell you this story myself, but I was delivering Christmas cards. I was a student at the university at the time, and I was talking to a man from the Pru when men from the Pru were pretty well ubiquitous. He had just retired, and he told me that he always invested in new unit trusts because, and he waited for them to double, and then he sold out because he thought that unit trust managers lost interest after that. So I listened to that. I thought, he doubled his money. Right, sounds good to me. So I took my money out of savings certificates from the post office and invested in unit trusts, which sounds great. There's one slight problem. The year was 1972. And I think, really, essentially taught me all I ever needed to, all I ever learned about investment. I mean, I've done all this actuarial stuff and I've done all this practical investment stuff, but in a way that's just detail. And I suppose that is where this paper comes from. You have to look at what the liabilities are that you're matching, which is really what we're all about. So I will start my talk. The purpose of my paper is to look at the options a retired person in drawdown has. It is primarily an attempt to provide rational answers to the questions retired people have along the lines of, what do I do now? What should I plan to do in the future? Most of the paper is concerned with equity investment in retirement, what it offers, the issues to be considered, and what can be done to make it easier. It also considers these matters in the context of the wider issues retired people face. The answers the paper gives are necessarily imperfect, but they're also intended to throw light on the fundamental nature of the questions. With the rise in pensions freedoms, post-retirement investment is now the pensioner's responsibility. This paper considers the possibility of basing investment income on equity dividends, even for quite ordinary investors, and looks at the pitfalls and opportunities. So let's move on to that one. In the context of past experience. First, central bank action forced down interest rates, making annuities unattractive. And so the legislation changed to move the responsibility for post-retirement investment and future income provision to the pensioner, as advised by the financial services industry. Most people's investment experience starts off with their building society account, and then maybe it's about how they can get a better return than their building society can give them. The question is therefore, if I put my money in the stock market or whatever, will I have more money in 10 years' time than if I kept my money where it is? Is there a risk that I will have yet less? The question is, how much money have I got now, and how much capital will I have then? It is all essentially about capital, because before retirement, that is generally the issue. However, the new question they are dealing with is, if I invest in the stock market, will I get more income than if I purchase an annuity? This is not about capital at all. This is all about income, and most private individuals have no experience of dealing with such a question. And I'm not sure that as a broad generalization, the industry itself really understands the question, as it is so focused on capital performance over the last 12 months, 5 years, or whatever. Compared with considering the potential investment returns in the robotics industry, the question of whether the investor will still be able to afford to visit the grandchildren in 10 years' time seems positively mundane. It is, however, not only one of the most important questions any investor will have to face, it is also one of the most difficult to solve. Moreover, the more limited the financial resources of the investor, the more difficult a problem it is. Bond investment seems to be the obvious answer, but bonds yield less than equities yield, and so equities need to be at least looked at. There are bonds that offer higher yields, but generally at the expense of more equity-type risk. And for bonds, the very best outcome that they can get is what they were promised. With bonds, the risk might be smaller, but it is all one way, and that way is negative. With equities, the risks are greater, but there is also upside potential. Looking at the history of gilt yields, goes back to 1900. Up until the mid-1950s, it was quite usual for gilt yields to be less than equity yields because gilt coupons were safe and dividends were risky. After the 1950s, gilt yields exceeded equity yields because dividends rose over time, whereas gilt coupons always remained the same. Today's relationship between gilt and equity yields may be a throwback to some past time, but even so, it is extreme. Any reversion to previous norms would probably involve a significant rise in gilt yields, which would imply significant falls in capital values. To put some scale on this, for example, if interest rates on 10-year gilts rose from current levels to 5%. That would involve a 25% capital loss. People have been talking about gilt yields rising for some time, and largely it hasn't happened. However, for someone who is retiring now, who is likely to be retired for 20 or 30 years, it is very likely to happen in their lifetime. If that happens, the market values of all except the very shortest dated gilts could plummet, destroying the apparent capital security that bond investment has seemed to provide in the past. Forecasting gilt yields or anything about the future of the market can be dangerous. If you think that current conditions tell you anything about the next 20 or 30 years, consider the gilt market as seen in 1980. It was known that people taking out pensions contracts would eventually want to take a pension from those contracts, and it was felt that they ought to have some reassurance about the level of pension they were buying. And so many contracts included an annuity rate guarantee. Gilt yields had only fallen to 2.5% once since the beginning of the century, and that was after the war in 1946, and it was very temporary. We were well past that now, and now normality had returned. If an annuity rate guarantee was based on an interest rate of less than 4%, the guarantee would obviously not cost very much, even if it was called on at all. But at least it provided policyholders with some level of reassurance. As you can see, in the worst case, it might offer some useful protection to policyholders whose retirement coincided with a temporary fall in interest rates to extremely low levels. It might even have a catchy name, like a 10-to-1 policy, with £10 of capital guaranteeing £1 of income. But this is what the future held. 20 years later, those guarantees threatened to bring down the insurance companies giving them, and in the case of the Equitable, it did bring the company down. The lesson from this is that what happened in the stock market over the last 20 years is not necessarily a reliable guide to what might happen in the next 20 years. A much longer term perspective is needed. I'm talking about equities, but equities are risky. Whoa. Where have I gone? No, equities are risky. The chart is based on figures in the Barclays Capital Equity Gilt Study and shows equity market performance on a log scale. Using a normal scale means that the absolute size of equity market movements in the early years is tiny as compared with the current levels, and so a lot of detail is lost. Using a logarithmic scale gives a far more realistic impression of the scale of market volatility in the past. Stock market falls of 40% or more were seen in 1931 following a peak in 1928, in 1940 following a peak in 1936. It was then relatively quiet until 1972, when the stock market fell over 70% in 1974, and I lost half my money. There then followed two crashes of over 40%, the first following the dot-com bubble in 2002, and then the financial crisis in 2007-09. In the US, their big stock market crash was the Wall Street crash, where the peak-to-trough fall was over 90%. That is, $100 became $10. The US then had its Second World War drop of 40%, bottoming out in 1944. Their crash in the early 70s was less severe than in the UK, but it was still over 40%. They also had 40% crashes after the dot-com bubble and during the financial crisis. In the last 100 years, both stock markets have experienced falls of over 40% five times. There is therefore a good chance that someone retiring today will see at least one more. Crashes on this scale cannot be avoided, and so the focus must be on having a portfolio that can survive such a crash. And this is difficult for an investor constantly taking income from that portfolio. Dividends, however, have generally been somewhat more stable. From 1900 onwards, dividend payments from UK quoted companies basically fell or more accurately, plummeted. Dividends finally bottomed out in 1919, having fallen 66% from their level in 1900. However, 1990 was the end of World War I, and 1900 itself seems to have been an extraordinary year, possibly because it was the last year of the 19th century. They seem to know about those things then. Although dividends didn't recover their 1900 levels, they did rise subsequently to peak in 1929, and then falling by a third in 1933. The 1930s was a time of deflation and falling prices. Between 1929 and 1933, prices fell by 13%, but the fall was still 25%, even in real terms. Subsequently, nominal dividends held up well, with a maximum dividend fall of less than 15% between 1997 and 2002. Assuming that there is no repeat of the early years of the 20th century, falls on such a scale can be dealt with through some sort of smoothing mechanism, such as this. Hold 1 year of income payments as a cash buffer. Payments are made to the pensioner equal to 90% of the dividend receipts in the previous year, subject to that payment being no less than that paid in the previous year, and no increase in the payments until the cash balance is at least equal to 1 year's payments. Any excess income is reinvested with preference given to reinstating the cash balance to a level equal to next year's annual payment to the pensioner. In effect, all excess income is kept as cash until the cash balance is replenished. It is worth noting this cuts out any direct relationship between dividend receipts and income distributions to the investor. It is also to be noted that the reinvested income will provide some rate of income growth in addition to any underlying growth in dividends. Looking at the effect of this, back testing against historic market performance, the suggested plan for smoothing would have worked under actual stock market conditions going back to the First World War. It should be noted that although after 1997 the maximum fall in nominal dividends was only 15%, the recovery took a long time, and hence the drawdown in cash balance under the plan was still 23%. It took 6 years for the balances to fall to that level and 2 years to then recover. To get a worse depletion in cash balances, you have to go back to the fall in dividends after 1930. Although after 1929, the fall would have been a more concerning 85%. The fall in cash balances reached its maximum after 6 years, but the recovery took a further 9 years, although the slow recovery might have had something to do with World War II. However, if conditions similar to those experienced in the very early years of the 20th century are repeated, it will clearly fail, as in practice the maximum drawdown in cash balances is 100%. On the positive side, you have to go back over a century to see a time when these conditions actually occurred. However, for the retired, this is really the wrong question. The real question is, in the unlikely event that I'm still alive in 50 years' time, will I still be able to afford to pay the utility bills? Any investment strategy must be focused on enabling the retired to continue to meet their living expenses, however much they might be. If prices are rising, their income needs to rise too. Focusing on maintaining income in nominal terms is missing the point. For the retired, inflation is a big issue, if not the big issue. One tends to think of inflation as meaning that a drink or a meal costs 5 or 10% more than it did last year, which tends to focus on as a process, rather like breaking your arm. It hurts a lot at the time, and this is a major inconvenience for a while. But eventually you recover, and then things are much the same as they were before. For the retired, inflation is more like an untreated brain tumor. The deterioration in their living standards is slow, and some days are better than others. But the deterioration is inexorable. The problem might be treated, and the deterioration might stop on the case of inflation slow down. But the loss in purchasing power is permanent. In fact, the problem with inflation is that what happens with it is that the value of debts falls and the real value of assets also falls. And the net effect of that is a large transfer of wealth from the retired population to the working population. And that transfer of wealth is permanent. For inflation, we do have historic data. This chart shows something roughly equivalent to the retail price index since 1751. And once again, this is the rate of change that matters rather than the absolute price level. So a logarithmic scale is used. What is notable is that high rates of inflation for a sustained period is a very modern phenomenon, restricted to the period since World War II. There was inflation in the 18th century, which took off during the run-up to and during the Napoleonic Wars. This was followed by a period of relative price stability. Indeed, over the period of Queen Victoria's reign, which was also a period of rapid growth for the UK economy, prices actually fell by 8.5%. Prices rose slightly in the run-up to World War I. Then during the war and its immediate aftermath, inflation took off, averaging 17% per annum between 1914 and 1920. This was followed by a period of quite severe price deflation, with prices falling at 3.5% per annum between 1920 and 1933. Inflation only really started to take off during the war years. Even then, it only averaged about 5 or 6%, which was much less during the World War I, but it remained at a high level thereafter, accelerating in the 1970s, peaking at around 24%, even above World War I rates, before easing off after 1990. But by historic standards, inflation remained high. This is new. Until modern times, inflation has not been the norm, except in time of war. But with central banks actually targeting 2% inflation, someone retiring today must assume that inflation will remain the norm for the rest of their lifetime. For once, assuming that this time it's different is the safe option. Looking at real capital growth, real capital and income growth of equities over the same period, we get this picture. Two things are clear. Share prices have been much more volatile in real terms. And after World War I, dividends have been relatively stable and growing in real terms, albeit slowly and with setbacks. The faster growth in share prices overall is a reflection of the fact that since 1900, dividend yields have almost halved. It should be noted that inflation-adjusted equity prices were pretty well range-bound between 1900 and 1960. In the last 120 years, almost the whole of the real growth in share prices occurred between 1980 and 2000. Real dividends have been more stable, and they have been essentially range-bound since 1900, apart from this serious drop in the first 20 years of the 20th century. The positive performance of equity prices is therefore primarily a reflection of an equity re-rating. Given that fact, there must be some question mark over the predictive power of any historic equity price data set, including the 1980 to the 2000 period. The next question is, how would an income based on dividends have fared against a conventional level annuity or an RPI-linked annuity? In other words, how well could a dividend income have protected a retiree from the effects of inflation? Inflation was at its worst during the 1970s, and real dividends peaked in 1965, falling by 37% in 1976 and eventually recovering in 1987. Note the double bottom structure. After 1976, real dividends staged a short recovery to 1980 and then fell back again, almost to the 1976 lows. Had an index-linked annuity been available, it would have protected a retiree's real income. For a conventional annuitant, however, the real value of £100 of nominal income would have fallen by 85% over the period. That is, the purchasing power of £100 was only equivalent to £14.60 in 1965 values, and that purchasing power would have continued to decline after 1987. By comparison, a dividend income would have recovered, and in the interim, the maximum loss in purchasing power would have been much less, although still 37% of the trough. It is notable that during this period, although dividends fell by 2.75% in 1967, in every other year during this period, nominal dividends rose. Moving forward, having looked at what happened in the 1970s, I was somewhat surprised that this was still a problem after 1996. Real dividends also fell after the 1996 peak, but this time the fall was only just under 25%, but they didn't recover until 2015. Note the double bottom structure once again. This time, changes in dividend taxation may have had an effect on dividend growth during the period. This period was different from the previous one in that this loss in purchasing power was partly caused by falls in nominal dividends. In this case, income from a level annuity would have lost 43% of its value by the end of the 20 years, or in other words, almost halved in its purchasing power. On both occasions, real dividends continue to grow, whereas the purchasing power of the fixed income continued to fall. Overall, the protection against inflation that dividend income provides is very imperfect, but it is much better than that provided by conventional bonds or level annuities. It should be pointed out that in current market conditions, even if dividends fell by 43%, equities would still yield more than gilts. Dividends are a car you can drive because there is feedback. When a retirement income is based on dividends, the investor can respond to events. If dividends rise, the investor has the option of taking more income or keeping their income the same and reinvesting the excess. If dividends fall, the investor has the option of reducing his own income, eating into the cash balance, or if that is no longer available, selling some of his portfolio. Basing income on total return leaves the investor at the mercy of the frenetic changes in market sentiment. But basing income on dividends is much more susceptible to rational management. This is really a simple option that the investor can at least understand. Control is a real issue. One can do a Monte Carlo simulation, but the historic data would indicate that market volatility changes over time and must therefore be some uncertainty over how market volatility will change in the future. In any event, there is great uncertainty over the frequency of black swan events where markets fall over 40%, and they are the ones that really matter. In practice, for an individual investor, market risk is essentially catastrophic in nature, and every investor is in a particular financial situation. A 90-year-old with care home fees to meet is in a very different position from a 65-year-old who might be able to cut back on next year's holiday, or maybe get a job and bring in that little extra money. As an actuary, one relates to risk in statistical terms, but most people don't understand that. Relate to risk emotionally and seek to interpret it in a way they can understand. Dividends fall because a business did badly last year, or because the outlook has deteriorated. Retailers are having a hard time because of online competition. If a retailer therefore cuts its dividend, an investor can understand and relate to that and even respond to it. Market price movements, on the other hand, are perceived as being the result of the actions of a mysterious group of market speculators. This is not the whole story, but there is some truth in it. It is well beyond most people's understanding, and so they don't know how to respond to a risk they don't understand. An investor faced with a fall in dividend income can do a number of things. Invest in higher yielding shares, cut back on the level of income taken, sell assets, or cut expenditure. How an investor rationally responds to a fall in market values is far less clear-cut. The other issue that retired face is insuring against living to age 110, or even 120 if we have reached that point. Annuities offer good protection against longevity risk. Index-linked annuities give protection against inflation. Index-linked annuities are backed by index-linked gilts, which offer negative real returns. Question: when does good insurance outweigh poor investment? My answer is when the term of the investment is short. For the retired, running out of money because they live too long is a problem. My view is that the trade-off becomes acceptable when the term of the investment is 4 years or less, which translates into a life expectancy of about 7 years. My suggested rule of thumb is therefore that if £100,000 buys an index-linked annuity of £14,000 per annum, annuity purchase ought to be considered very seriously. This, in effect, assumes annuity purchase at some time after age 85, or perversely, if the retiree's state of health deteriorates earlier. I recognise that it's counterintuitive to buy an annuity early if health issues cause the reduced life expectancy. But where life expectancy is reduced, insurers are likely to offer better rates, and so a deterioration in health affects both sides of the risk-reward trade-off. However, so far I consider the nature of various investment options, but what remains to be done is to translate this into a more practical plan for someone who has retired or will be retiring soon. But first, the problem with equities. Equities are perpetual securities with an uncertain coupon and sentiment-driven price volatility in the meantime, making controlled divestment problematic. This is particularly a problem for those pensioners relying on eating into capital to provide some of their income in retirement. Part of the solution could be a suitably structured split capital investment trust. This particular kind of split capital investment trust has, for illustration purposes, a life of 20 years and two share classes. It has income shares. These are entitled to all the dividend income from the trust assets and a nominal amount on wind-up, say a tenth of a penny. These would be attractive to pensioners looking for a controlled way to realise capital. They may also be attractive to insurers and pension funds with pensioner liabilities. The second share class would be capital shares. These would be entitled to all of the trust capital on wind-up, less the income share's nominal entitlement, and no income in the meantime. These might be attractive to high-rate taxpayers preferring to pay capital gains tax eventually rather than income tax immediately. It should be noted that although this type of investment trust no longer existed, they have existed in the past and they could exist again, this time in a new context. Translating this into an actual portfolio for a recently retired person. The example portfolio has a value of £100,000. With £65,000 invested in income shares, £30,000 in a tracker fund, and £5,000 in cash. This implicitly assumes a plan to buy an annuity after 20 years. The portfolio is mainly income shares to provide the disinvestment mechanism. There is a cash buffer. The remainder is invested in a tracker fund. When the split capital investment trust is wound up, the tracker fund is sold, and the proceeds, along with the cash balance, are used to buy an index-linked annuity. The allocation to cash plus the allocation to the conventional tracker fund roughly equates to 7 years' income in order to provide for that eventual annuity purchase. Again, it is assumed that the pensioner only takes 90% of the dividend income, with the excess reinvested, providing an inbuilt mechanism for dividend income to tend to rise by 0.5% per annum above the rate of underlying dividend growth. It would also be a mechanism for providing additional growth in the capital value of the portfolio at the wind-up date, and therefore the amount available to buy the annuity. Although for the sake of simplicity, it was assumed the investment was in a UK tracker fund, when it gets to the nitty-gritty of actual portfolio construction, diversification of income sources is at least as important as diversification of capital risk. However, these days, the UK equity market offers very limited income diversification, with much of the dividend income coming from a very limited number of stocks and limited exposure to some areas of economic activity, which implies the need for international diversification. In addition, particularly for the small investor, their own personal dependence on the UK economy is naturally high through state pension, NHS and local authority services, etc. With an international portfolio, there is currency risk. But that risk is mainly associated with one single currency, the pound sterling, as the risk associated with other specific currencies can be diversified away. This provides further inflation protection as changes in the external value of the pound sterling will feed through to UK inflation, and so the currency risk is correlated positively with the pensioner's own inflation risk. Currency risk is also another source of mainly uncorrelated risk and further aids diversification. However, this does introduce another practical problem with international investment, particularly for an income investor: withholding tax. Withholding tax is tax companies are required by their local tax authorities to deduct from dividends paid to foreign holders of their shares. Note, the local tax authority depends on where the company is registered, not where the shares are traded. The rate of withholding tax varies depending on the country, but it can be up to 30% or even more in some cases. Frequently, some or all of the withholding tax can be reclaimed from the country levying it, depending on the terms of the double tax treaty between the company's local tax authority and the investor's local tax authority. Any remaining withholding tax can generally be offset against the investor's own local tax liability. However, if the investor is not themselves taxable, the tax is lost. Pension funds are tax-free, but unit trusts, investment trusts, and ETFs are as well. As they are not themselves taxable, they cannot pass any tax credit onto their investors. It is worth noting that it is generally accepted internationally that dividends ought to be taxed, but not taxed twice. The double tax treaty is therefore there to determine how that tax is shared between the country where the company is resident and the country where the investor is resident. However, if the legal owner of the shares is not itself taxable, such as a unit trust, ETF, or investment trust, those intentions can be frustrated, particularly as in many double tax treaties, the net rate of withholding tax that can be reclaimed depends on the tax status of the investor in its home jurisdiction, with tax-free investors unable to reclaim any withholding tax. In this case, the investor will be a tax-free fund, even though most of the investors in that fund are not. This is an example of the effects of withholding tax. I've used for these purposes a selection of Vanguard ETFs because they cover broad regions of the world. They're not particularly specialist in income. Generally, they're just there. These ETFs just give a broad indication of the scale of the problem. For Japanese and American companies, about 15% of their dividends is taken by the company's own local tax authorities before they ever get to the investor. In Europe, local tax authorities take about 10% of the dividends paid. However, it must be appreciated that for tax purposes, the EU does not exist, and each country in the EU negotiates its own double tax treaties. It should also be noted that for the developed Asia-Pacific area, comprising Australia, Hong Kong, Singapore, and New Zealand, withholding tax deductions are particularly low, making the region attractive to an income investor seeking overseas diversification, much better than the US. If you are a taxable investor in these ETFs, you'll be taxed on the dividend income after the deduction of the withholding tax, but no tax credit will be given. It is worth pointing out the domicile of the fund is where it is registered. So, for example, Vanguard's ETFs, in common with most other ETFs quoted in the UK, are domiciled in Ireland, although some others will be domiciled in Luxembourg. Generally speaking, the UK has the most extensive range of double tax treaties, and Luxembourg the least extensive. The domicile of the fund can therefore also affect the amount of income an investor receives from the fund, with a UK fund suffering the least amount of deducted withholding tax. However, if the Vanguard ETFs were UK domiciled, the amount of the withholding tax deducted might be lower, but not by that large amount. I would say probably Europe would be the biggest item where deduction of withholding tax would probably be more like 7.5% rather than 10%. There is more extensive analysis in my paper on this issue. Looking at what the industry can do, provide ETFs that distribute income rather than accumulate it, as many with more specialist mandates do. Provide income-focused ETFs that are international and take account of yields, but which are withholding tax aware in their index construction. Working out the level of income in an accumulating fund is not easy, and even if a fair estimate is made, that means realizing a small number of units, and for small trades, dealing expenses can be significant. Withholding tax is country-specific, but country-specific ETFs tend to accumulate dividends. Creating an index favoring companies in low withholding tax jurisdictions will provide serious benefit to income investors. The fund management industry generally is not that attuned to the needs of the retired. Their primary need is for an income, and preferably one that keeps pace with inflation. Frequently, fact sheets on funds do not even give dividend yields, let alone dividend histories. If a retired investor wants to take advantage of a growth opportunity, such as technology or emerging markets, it will frequently come at a cost to immediate income. But if it gives better dividend growth in the future, it may be a good option. However, the information is frequently not easily available to find out what the cost to immediate income is. As regards income investment, at the moment the industry has not really got beyond products focused on high immediate income yields. What the investment trust industry can do? Well, primarily, it could provide split capital investment trusts with income shares to aid investors in this disinvestment problem. It could also promote annuities to investors in income shares as the wind-up date approaches. Promoting annuities may seem a little idealistic, but many life offices are also fund managers. And anyway, the two industries working together make a very good fit in this situation. It would show some social responsibility. And anyway, holders of income shares would not have much capital invested at the wind-up date. And so the managers would not be seeking reinvestment of those monies. What the life insurance industry can do? Well, it could recognize that poor bond yields have less effect on annuity rates at older ages, and older pensioners are as much in need of a longevity insurance as anybody else. It could consider offering an annuity-type product based on an underlying equity portfolio constructed on the principles described previously. It might even offer income-targeted investments in the life fund based on overseas investment, as when it comes to withholding tax, being taxable can actually be a positive advantage. A suitable underlying portfolio for an annuity based on the dividend income would, in effect, require that there be a range of split capital investment trusts with income shares to be available to match those liabilities. Blue sky thinking, maybe. But if such investment trusts existed, annuities could be based on the with-profit model, or annuity payments could track a suitably constructed income index, not a capital index, an income index. If some stabilisation of income levels was sought by holding back dividends, it might be appropriate to combine the two. The purpose of this paper, to question the extent to which bond investment really is suitable for the retired, given the scale of the inflation risk they face. To question whether advisors and the FCA, for that matter, should be so focused on capital security in nominal terms, when what is important to pensioners is income security in real purchasing power terms. To put forward some ideas about how a retiree's portfolio might be constructed. To point out that longevity risk is still very real, and annuities do offer a solution. But given current investment conditions, maybe insurers need to be more focused on older age groups. To float some ideas about possible products that might help solve the investment in retirement problem. I would like to finish with a warning stroke explanation. If history does repeat itself, what period in history does market performance since 2000 most look like? Yes, there we go. Well, I ask you where we are now, gents. Are we in there? Or are we there? Which takes us back to the 1920s, the 1930s. I'm not sure, but I do ask a question. Getting back to the... You listen to me droning on, now it's your turn to ask questions, and my turn to see if I have any answers. Have I gone off the edge? Do you want to go to the last slide? Do the last slide? Or comments?
On Keating, a guest. Ian, I'm amazed that you could go through such a lengthy and thorough presentation on dividend income without mentioning the appalling buyback. They are now as more important than dividends in terms of distributing corporate cash flow. And generally in hollowing out companies. The second and related topic is, given that the pensions regulator is now trying to impose limitations on dividends in the absence of extra contributions to DB pensions, what does that mean for dividend growth?
Problem, particularly in buybacks, have been an increasing problem in the US, particularly. Although I actually noticed that dividends have, that what the effect has been a drop in dividend yields in the US, although dividends actually do seem to have been rising recently in real terms. Yes, I think that is an issue. I think it is. But one must remember that, in a way, it is an issue that results from the structure of the tax system. in part, and it also has the benefit from the company's point of view, that whereas if they pay a dividend, there is an implied assumption that that might be repeated next year. With buybacks, it is very much a one-off thing. I'm not sure that that is not happening in the UK. It is fairly common. I'm not sure that it will go quite to the extent it has in the US. As I say, it is partly a function of the tax system. It is also a function of the way remuneration is structured for the boards in United States boards, where it is very much related to share price. So they do have an incentive to distribute that way. That was the first question. The second question? Pensions. Yes, I think that what you're saying is that there is a demand for companies to contribute more to their pension funds before distributing dividends. Yes? That yes, that is a point. I mean, but it is specific to particular companies. So yes, it is an issue. Yes, it needs to be considered. But the point of this paper was to point out that dividends have provided much better stability than share prices. And if investors are seeking an income, it is probably safer for them to base it on dividends than it is to base it on share prices and be exposed to market volatility.
John Hunter, I'm a guest, I'm not an actuary. I was once a mathematician. I had a career in industry and a financial career in Iclea in a FTSE 100 company, and I am retired and I'm an investor. All this is by way of saying, making sure that I can say something stupid and you'll be fairly kind to me. I very much liked Ian having this single expression for what retirement planning is all about, and in his case, after 50 years, you want to pay the utility bill. The one I prefer is the retirement planning should be to enable you to die a pauper without regret. To die a pauper without regret. So the aim is to have no money when you die. And to do it with security, in other words, without regret. The other thing I would say is that any rigid plan that's set at any age is not a good idea because of all the uncertainties that you mentioned. Flexibility is all, and it seems to me that the key decision to be made at any time is how much in cash, how much in equities, how much am I spending? Those are the three key decisions. Incidentally, I found your paper one of the most interesting ones I've read for a long time on the business of investment. Really, really interesting. But I'm now going to make a criticism of it, which is the great emphasis you have on the difference between dividend and capital. I find hard. A dividend is just a transfer of my money to myself. I own a slug of a company and it gives me some of my money. The company is 100, it gives me 5. I've got 105 and I spend 4 because that's a decision I made, so I'm left with 101 basically. And my next decision is to whether to alter the 101 and change it into 92 and 9. I had to do the maths really carefully then. That's no different from a company which doesn't pay a dividend and turns 100 into 105 in 1 year. My position is the same. But the mechanism that you recommend makes me change my expenditure between the two, and that I don't really understand that. And instinctively, a mechanism which says that I spend less than my dividend income every year or otherwise suffered can't be right. You know, the right thing, if I'm to die a pauper, has got to be to spend more than that.
We've invented a solution for you to die a pauper. It's called an annuity. We did this years ago.
I say without regret.
Without regret. Well.
All of us in this room are reasonably comfortably off and behave reasonably sensibly with money. I was going to say I have a friend, but it's wrong. My wife has an acquaintance who's she's a bright woman. She's age 50, so she has a job, which is important for this story. And she's divorced, and she has a house. And she goes on 3 or 4 expensive holidays every year. And she finances them by remortgaging the house. So every year, she remortgages her house, spends the money, and gets on to the next year. Now, that's obviously nuts, but it's good for her. It's good for her, and I think it fits her a definition of dying a pauper without regret. We're all different.
I would like to spend my money on wine, women, and song, although I suspect that I'll waste most of it otherwise.
Sensible person, their advisor. And I think the reality here is that the vast majority of people with DC pots haven't got advisors, nor indeed have they got that much money. In order to get an income of roundly £10,000, you're going to start with a pot of £300,000, I think 3.5% or thereabouts. Very few pots are above £300,000, an awful lot of people. Have got much smaller pots. They don't take advice, and therefore the issues here. Interesting, suitable for a small part of the market, but certainly not for the vast majority of the market. And I think it could be dangerous for them, because even if their advisors are vaguely on top of it, they might review their portfolios yearly, and of course the dividends and the income could significantly fall, and capital values could fall in that time. So the other interesting point that you do make, and it's on the screen there, of course, is that annuities do offer some solution, and some work I did when I was working at the regulator a while ago suggested that the mortality drag and other things suggested annuity purchase perhaps around 80. This was more than 10 years ago. It's possibly gone up to 85 or so now. And equally, at that point in time, people's portfolios are typically smaller because they do use up the capital, as the previous speaker said, and arguably they're less able to manage their money since their brain power probably deteriorates with age. So annuity purchase at some point, possibly earlier than Ian was suggesting, is probably still a good idea for an awful lot of investors. Alternatively, because the deferred annuity, so you buy at age 60 or whenever you retire, you buy an annuity that starts at 80 or 85, a deferred annuity, can be a good idea because that minimises your tail risk. If I can just touch on one or two other points that you made, Equitable did not actually go broke. It came to its knees, but it did not actually go broke. You also mentioned in your paper that insurance companies back annuities by bonds. Well, that is true to some extent, but they also invest in infrastructure and property and other things that yield somewhat more than bonds, and therefore improve the return that they can offer investors.
We're expecting to answer that, aren't we?
And Chu Chen, fellow.
A couple points. I think one is if you just consider to track the inflation, should be a index-linked government bond will be a better choice compared to the equity market. Second point is if your focus is based on the dividend income, then what that means you miss out a large chunk of the market will give you better capital return. For example, all the tech company currently do not pay a dividend, but they have been the fast grower for the past year until the last month.
Yes, I would like to comment on that. I think this is what I am arguing against, is that if I was your age, I'd be looking to make the maximum return. But somebody who is retired is looking to have an income that they can rely on, that can pay for their living expenses. And that is a different investment objective. And I think we need, as a profession, we need to appreciate that somebody who is retired and looking to live on their savings so far needs to realize that the problem is an income problem. I mean, we've actually seen tech stocks drop very significantly of late. I don't know what effect that's going to have on the long-term profitability or long-term profits of Alphabet or Apple, but for an income investor who's looking to take money out of the market on a regular basis, that is potentially very dangerous, to be forced to sell equities that are extremely volatile. At least if you focus on dividends, you have some reassurance that you're not actually destroying your portfolio.
Bryn Davis Fellow, it's an interesting paper, and thanks very much for all the work you've done. What would have been interesting is some sort of back testing to see how it would have worked out in practice. But of course, that begs the question of the extent to which the future is going to be anything like the past. Now, I take it from what you've presented that bequest motive has got no role in this model, because the end game is buying an annuity. There's no bequest motive involved here. You expect the people to buy an annuity, so they're not looking to pass on the money to anyone else. So that raises the question of why is it worth all this bother in order to avoid buying an annuity earlier? How much better will your model be in practice than just buying an annuity straight away? And I've just done a little bit of calculating on my mobile phone, because there's a handy annuity calculator available from the Money Advice Service. And I'm also taking it from your figures, 90% of the dividend income, your model suggests, therefore, that you're aiming to produce £5,000 a year income from your 100,000. So my question is, at what age can you buy an RPI-linked annuity for £100,000? Because that would achieve what you're trying to achieve. And my little iPhone tells me that it's in the mid-70s. Now, why don't I just buy an annuity in my mid-70s and not wait until I'm almost at death's door? What's wrong with an annuity?
Sorry, there are actually... the objective here is to wind down capital. So yes, the idea is that you have an income from, I suppose, ideally 65. But the principle is that you will be winding down that capital between 65 and 80, and the income shares provide you with a mechanism for doing that. And at 85, you could buy an index-linked annuity. If you bought an index-linked annuity straight away, you'd probably be looking at around about £3,000 of income or £100,000. Was I'm actually generating about £5,000 with this.
Okay, well, that's my question.
This structure.
At what age can you buy an index-linked annuity of £5,000 a year with £100,000? Do you know what that age is?
£5,000
a year with a £100,000 capital payment.
Well, I would accept your answer. You said 70s.
Yeah, well, okay.
I mean, I'm not going to argue with you about what it is, but, you know, you still got to live for the next 10 years.
Yeah, well, you're getting your 5,000 a year.
Sorry?
You're getting your 5,000 a year. My question is, why is what you're proposing any better? How much better? How much extra income will the individual receive through your method from age 75 by sticking to your method, as opposed to buying an annuity at 75? How much better off are they going to be?
Well, then at 75, you would have, at 75, you would have a shorter split capital investment trust producing an even higher yield, so you would have more income.
No, but you... There isn't a split capital. What we had was your portfolio, which yielded income of 90% of the dividends,
which assumed that £65,000 of the £100,000 was invested in this income shares of a split capital investment trust, which does not, under current conditions, exist. Is the answer to the question?
Hi, I'm Dan Chip. I'm a student. My question is, if your pension pot was to rise or fall significantly, do you think the best tactic would be to reduce your pension pot or to increase it in line with the market rises and falls, or just to try and withdraw the same real amount every year?
How old is this person? Somebody, you talk about somebody who's actually retired already, or somebody who is saving for retirement?
Say they've just retired a couple of years or something.
I'm trying through this talk to try and organize matters in such a way that the person does not actually need to sell to actually make a sale of a security in order to generate the income that they need. That is what I see as being the most dangerous aspect of investment, which is investment is relatively easy. It's disinvestment which is really dangerous, because if stock markets do halve in value, they can lose more than half their value. And if a pensioner is dependent on selling shares into such a market, then, you know, if they got £100,000 invested and they're looking for income of £5,000, it's fine, you know, if they sell 5% of their portfolio. But if the market value of that £100,000 portfolio drops to £50,000, then they've got to sell 10% of their portfolio. And that's what's really dangerous.
Okay.
Hi, Lawrence here, student, recent winner of the SOAS AGM champagne. So I'm hungry for more. Pardon me if I'm not well read on the history of this, but can't believe this is a new problem. Imagine people must have been wondering how to save for retirement for centuries. Is there something that's happened recently which has led you to write this paper, which makes the matter more complex? Or why do you think that a model solution, hopefully, hasn't been developed in the past?
I don't know the answer to that question. I find it very strange that back 30 years ago, there was such a wide selection of split capital investment trusts that did address this sort of question, and that no longer exists. I think we've taken over this. We've become too focused. I don't know whether it's because of the way the industry is structured. It's become too focused on last year's performance figures and not looking at what the investment objectives of the investor are. Sorry, Martin. Well, it was compulsory, yes. That is, yes, okay. It's where I started from. Thanks.
David Simmons, I'd like to thank you for the paper, in particular, thank you for a very well-written paper. I thought it was a very interesting and very easy to read, and a lot of work went into it. I think for me, the biggest takeaway is, and I agree that the importance of having perhaps a bit more focus on how income from equities can be used to actually match the liability outgo. And I think that kind of big picture for me was the biggest takeaway. And I agree with that idea. My question is that who might actually benefit from the ideas that you're suggesting, because it strikes me as being a bit too complicated for an individual managing an individual pension pot. So if we're sitting here as an actuarial society, who might we be targeting this idea at? I mean, is it more for, say, larger pension funds who have a large amount of income to match, but with a large amount of equities? Is that who can use these ideas, or were you really thinking about an individual with an individual pension pot? And if so, is that really practical for them?
The paper looks at various aspects of income investment. I think probably my main purpose in writing the paper was to say that income investment is a totally different approach, that we are focused too much on capital performance, too much on the short term, too little on long-term income for the retired. Certainly you can speak to stockbrokers, and they do have clients who say to them, I don't care what happens to the capital performance over the next year. What I want is to have the income coming in. And those are fairly sophisticated investors. There is actually, you know, already private individuals out there who are investing for income. I think more private individuals ought to be investing for income. We've got to move the conversation. And that, I suppose, is what I like. I can certainly see that if we could produce split capital investment trusts such as I've suggested, I can see that there might well be a market for them, because there will be investors who realize that they want to realize capital. And I think we simply need to address the income investor market. Sorry.
Martin White. I think I'd like to echo some other points. I thought it was a very, very interesting paper. A few things that have been said I want to comment on. One is about split capital investments. Why don't they exist now, and why did they exist before? Dead simple. High taxes. When there were high rate taxpayers who didn't want income, capital gains was better. It was an obvious best thing to buy the capital units of those. And of course, any story about tax helps financial sector to sell products. So that's why they existed. I think the big story in the paper, it's the result of suddenly looking around and saying, my God, the reverse yields gap is back with us. A lot of us, even a few years ago, wouldn't have conceived of a time when fixed interest investments gave a zero or negative real return, but equities yielded quite a lot better. So just taking account of that, it does mean that if you buy a fixed interest long-term asset, you are getting a crap return and you're suffering an amazing scope, as you put it, for a downside-only bet. You can have default, but just as important, you could have inflation. And with the huge amount of debt that's around now, I don't think it's all fully recognized, the scope for a huge default or inflationary event is just, it's got to be there. So in looking at it the way you're doing, you're saying, okay, there's risks on one side, there's risks on another, this seems a more sensible path. So I think I've got a lot of sympathy with that. You had a bit of pushback on the thing about buying an annuity at the end. I think it's worth, I think what your paper rather suggests, if you leave buying that annuity till quite late, but still targets the source of income you've been taking out, you will have more than enough money to buy an annuity, and you will have free capital for a bequest at that point.
Other yes, things sir. Being equal. Can I comment on a previous question? I had a question or comment on why index-linked gilts aren't better, because the return on index-linked gilts is -1.5% per annum in real terms, is the straight answer to that. It's actually negative. You are losing money in real terms.
Sorry. James, student. Sorry if this is too specific, but when you were talking about the international diversification, you said that the currency risk was only focused around the pound sterling. I was wondering if that was just assuming that your portfolio is still largely UK-based, and also sort of part two, when you said that it was currency risk was positively correlated with inflation risk, and that was a protection from inflation risk. I was just wondering if you could explain that in a bit more detail, please.
Well, yes, I suppose I'm rather strange, because I actually think that probably international investment is better than UK investment for most investors, because they are so tied up with the UK economy. They've got a house in the UK, they've got a pension from the UK government, they've got health insurance from the UK government, they've got so much tied up with the UK that, yeah, I think they do need to seriously consider getting out of the UK, particularly with Brexit. I'm not expressing any view as to what's going to happen on Brexit, but it's certainly, in my view, a certain area of uncertainty as to what effect that's going to have, and it could be quite major. So, no, I'm not necessarily comfortable with too much investment in the UK. I'm not sure that completely covers the risk. I think, you know, one of the major risks with Brexit, for example, is that we have a hard Brexit. people dump the pound like crazy and inflation takes off serious in this country. And that is an unlikely outcome, but it's certainly a feasible one.
Martin Lennon, definitely not a student anymore. A long way. But a fellow. I'd like to thank Ian for this paper. I think it's very interesting, and I think it potentially addresses a very pertinent issue, particularly in relation to the pension freedoms that we have, which I think you did mention that as a key spur for considering these issues and writing it. I think it would be even more useful if the proposed solution didn't involve a non-existent investment asset class, and it would be interesting to see what kind of effects were if instead you considered, you know, shares with high dividend yields, you know, possibly those that are traditionally regarded as safe havens for producing income, like utilities and things like that. As opposed to, as I say, these non-existent split capital investment trusts. I'd also just like to pick up on the previous point about currency matching. I mean, for the kind of people who are taking advantage of pension freedoms, quite a number of them may actually have some substantial liabilities going forward in their retirement in foreign currency. If they like going on holiday a lot, particularly if they have a holiday home overseas that needs maintaining and they like to eat out when they're there and that kind of thing. So it's not entirely silly to construct a portfolio which actually gives a bit of your income that ought to match prices, whether it's in the Eurozone or wherever else you might have might want to spend a lot of your time in retirement. My one particular question, and this is a bit of a techie question, I'm not an investment expert, so I may be messing this up. When you look back and said this is what dividend yields have done over the long time, in real terms or in cash terms, was that analysis done taking into account that some of the companies paying those dividends will have gone bankrupt and started paying you nothing? Or was it just based by multiplying running dividend yields or by kind of market capitalizations or market index levels at the time?
It was effectively done by multiplying the index by the yield on the index. So, pardon? There's no survivor bias, no. I mean, you've just taken the index. And, well, it's survivor bias to the extent, of course, that the UK stock market has survived. And that is probably a distortion because some stock markets have over the last 120 years disappeared. So there is some survivor bias. You raise the other point about I bring in a kind of share that doesn't exist. That is true. But on the other hand, the basic premise is that one is living on dividends. I've looked at dividend cash flows for an investment in the UK market. So that would show what would happen if you just invested in, say, a tracker fund, and it would illustrate what would have happened to the dividends. Currently, we are in a position where the yield on the all-share market, all-share index, is close to 4%, which means that an investor could have an income of close to 4% of their capital. They could improve upon that by focusing on income-producing shares. I would argue that it's probably dangerous considering the way the UK stock market has developed of late, because most of the dividend income from the UK stock market is actually coming from a very limited number of companies. And interestingly enough, most of the dividend income is actually from foreign companies. HSBC makes hardly any profit in the UK. It makes money hand over fist in Asia. BP is an oil company which operates mainly overseas, as is Shell. BAT is a tobacco company that I don't think it's got any operations at all in the UK, or, apart from head office function. So it is weird, actually, that the income from the UK stock market is actually associated with businesses that operate largely overseas anyway.
Hi, Shah Jahan Alam, I'm a fellow. Just a couple of observations, just thoughts that sort of come to mind. I think underlying your, why is it that this looks good? I think the underlying forces are that everyone's after income, but the other investors are more constrained than the individual investor that you're considering. So pension funds, they don't, because the other investors are, because of regulation or because they're scared of mark-to-market volatility, the pension funds and insurance companies, they can't buy this stuff, and therefore it looks cheaper. And I think that's just worth observing, that basically there's this trend for income. Everyone wants to generate income. So this is a cheaper option because maybe everything else is really expensive. And that may continue. Yeah. The other sort of point I'd like to make is that I think this is all well and good for people who have large pots. The point has been made, but the real problem we have is that people aren't saving enough for retirement. And we always say it's the people that aren't saving enough for retirement, but I think that there is a large issue here in terms of the split between the spoils of economic growth going to companies and shareholders rather than workers. And, you know, that's a bigger issue that needs to be dealt with for future generations. Yeah. Do you have any comments on that?
I think we've sort of lost sight of investment. Investing in the stock market sounds really dangerous to me if you look at all these charts. But, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if I think that every time my next-door neighbour pours Domestos down the toilet, he's contributing to my next year's pension because I'm invested in Unilever, that sort of makes complete sense to me in an emotional sense, that makes sense. And I think we do need to reconnect, you know, the fact that when you're retired you want to see where your money's coming from. And if I can see that my next door neighbor pouring Domestos down the toilet or buying a Cornetto for his kid is helping to pay my pension, that's very reassuring. If I start talking about ETFs or some smart guy who's outperforming the stock market, it all sounds a bit scary.
I think we just have time for one more, and I'm really sorry because I know other people want to ask questions, but we've come to the end of our time, so just one more quick question.
So it's Martin White again. We talked about safe havens like utilities. Has anyone been listening to the Labour Party's policy lately? In a way, the safe havens are the companies that the UK government can't take 10% of and give to the workers. So a little bit of thinking required there.
I would rather invest in overseas utilities.
Okay. I think, yeah, if you'd like to ask a question, we can slot it in.
Okay, Paul Langdon, a fellow. not really a question, just some observations. Really, it boils down to a difference between bonds, which are debt, equities that are equities that in the long term reflect growth. You want to, in the long term, invest more in equities than debt to get a better return. You said that the problem was disinvestment is dangerous. Well, investment is dangerous if you're doing it once. Investment typically happens gradually over time when you're doing your savings, and that's a good thing. And I think the point you make about effectively disinvesting gradually is a good point. There was another point I wanted to make, but it's eluding me. People are just very, very different. We're talking about rich people's problems. Poor people just don't have the choice to do this. They're reliant on the state, but they'll get a reasonable, if poor, income from the state.
I'm very much come from the position that that rich people have problems and difficulties, but it doesn't actually necessarily matter that much. Whereas it's the very poorest in our society that have problems that really, really matter to them. There might not be much money involved, but it's actually for the poor that these issues matter the most. Because I don't know, I mean...
They don't have the savings, though, do they?
It'd be nice if they did.
They used to have DB pensions.
I'd just like to thank everyone for your participation. I'm going to award the 2 bottles of champagne to Martin Lynham. I'm sorry if I heard your name incorrectly, but I think that was it. And to James Stephen down the back, so congratulations. If you could just come up to the table after the talk, I'll present them to you. There will be drinks and sandwiches served outside after, so please do join us if you can. And finally, I'd just like to thank Ian, and could everyone please thank him in the usual way. Thank you.